Okay. I am I am auditing this class. I'm sitting in the John class, but I'm listening to this class because they record this class, so I can listen to this one and I go to that one. So I am completely caught up. I have been with y'all in spirit this whole time, and I listened to the recordings before again over the past few days just to catch up with everything again. But if somehow the slides come up on the screen, you will have to thank some amazing audio video people, because I did it wrong again. The last time I brought my computer and Kendricks had to fumble around, and this time I sent them the file. So both ways are wrong, but so we may not have any slides tonight, but
so
that's
I'm not
okay.
Doing slides next week.
Perfect. Yeah, I'm not doing slides this week. okay, so how many folks have missed more than one class? Okay, so we've got a few. So I won't feel guilty spending just 4 or 5 minutes just kind of regrouping a little bit with where we've been. But sixth week of the quarter, but the fifth class, David has been in and out for multiple reasons, and he's only taught three of the classes, and he's missed every other week. So I know he's feeling disjointed, but the material is not just disjointed. Y'all have benefited greatly from what he has done, really from a high level, you know, the overview. So just to catch up if you've missed any, the first week he talked about what resonated with you in the Sermon on the Mount. We're studying the Sermon on the Mount. I should have said that first. You know, looking at this sermon with fresh eyes and these big picture ideas, and he quizzed y'all last week and you got him right. So, you know, the context matters. The crowds, the kingdom, and the conflict were the things in the first week. And then the second week, we kind of took a detour. Heidi's father had passed, and we started in on some of the material we're going to finish up tonight in the first 13 to 16 verses of Matthew 5. And I think the thought that we left you with then, and we want to continue tonight, is, are we all in? Are we all in with this material, with this content? And if we aren't, we aren't in at all. It's all or nothing. We're either all in or we aren't in at all. There's no middle ground. So the third week, you had 2 weeks to prepare for, but it was Jesus as teacher. And just a lot of good discussion about Jesus' style, his authority, how the crowds recognize that, and then the question I think that follows that class for us. We talked about the crowds being amazed. The word stunned is the word David used. The question for us is, are we stunned? Are we in awe? Are we amazed by him? And they thought of him as a nobody. We know better today. We've got so much history. We understand things that they didn't about the death, burial, and resurrection, but do we treat him better? Or do we treat him like a nobody in the way that we act? And so when we, the last connection there in week three was when we work the scripture to justify what we do, we are attempting to have the authority that only he owns. Does that make sense? Week four was Caleb Churchill. So we missed class in here, but the more I thought about Caleb's lesson, it was this, wasn't it? It was just a light in the world, salt and light. It was, Caleb just really encouraged me. That weekend encouraged me, but the lesson that he shared with us Sunday morning and then again Sunday night about the work going on in New York, was, it could have been this. He could have been in this class doing that. So I don't feel like we missed a lesson. And then the last week, David wrapped two big picture themes together, how the theme of the Bible, God looking for a people, is seen in the context here. You know, Adam and Eve to Israel to the church to you to me. Will we submit to becoming his people or rebel and attempt to be our own? And then Jesus as a preacher. So today, we're going to focus again on Matthew 5, verses 3 to 16, 1 to 16. We'll do all the way down to verse 16. And then next week, John has 17 to 20. 17 to 20, so you can prepare and be ahead for that. So I'd invite any thoughts anybody has as we get kicked off about the sermon so far, all of that context, maybe how it has hit you personally, you know, the things that we struggle with that resonate with us as we try to relate to what many call this greatest of all sermons. So anybody got any thoughts that they want to share about how you're connecting with this sermon so far? Okay. Well, I'll give you some more time to think. So as we start in the text tonight, you know, in that first week, the point was made that we tend to embrace things that we get, that we understand, and we move past the ones that we don't. And so maybe in this lesson, this context, that's less about our capacity to understand. And maybe, I'm talking about myself, maybe it's more about my motivation or my own justifications. You know, it's not that I move past things that I may not understand. I move past things that are hard. The things that are easy, not a lot of those in this sermon, but boy, I can get a hold of and I can work with and I can go, yeah, I feel good about that. And then just read fast to some of the other things. So we've spent a great deal of time understanding the audience, who this was written to, the context, how they would have perceived Jesus, how the crowds would have seen him and thought about him, the kingdom that he's talking about, what they would have thought about. And I think that insight is vital to really help us understand him, who he is, what he was dealing with, and to see him as he was. But tonight, we're going to start a little different challenge. I want to challenge you to further recognize this word as God's word, the word of his Son, as he came in the flesh and communicated with us. And it's timeless. And we have to connect to how it hits us. How it hits us collectively, and how it hits me personally and individually. So that's a more difficult thing to do, but if you can envision yourself sitting in a classroom like this and Jesus saying these words, and you know he sees right through your soul, and you know he's talking to you, and you know exactly where he's talking to you. That's where this sermon begins to take on a character that allows us to let it work in our life when it's not about them, it's about us. So think about the start here as we look at chapter 5, and this is where you would see all those verses up on the screen. You could just look up there, but just pretend. And, you know, the start of this sermon, there's crowds, and they're settling in. Imagine a Sunday morning for us, or just a few minutes ago, Sunday night, people are milling around and moving, and how do we know when we're fixing to start? Yeah, it starts getting quiet. We see somebody moving up to the front, and it's like general hubbub, right? And we just all kind of wind down, and we find our places, and we're waiting. We're settling down. That idle chatter goes away. People find their seats. The speaker gets up. And so think about how Jesus starts this sermon. When we go to the text here, when he saw the multitudes, he went up on the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. And opening his mouth, he began to teach them. This is kind of backwards from the way that we do it. Everybody's just around, and Jesus sees them, and he goes and he sits down. The people that are interested, they start migrating to Jesus. And they're like, I want to hear what he has to say. And they come sit down. I don't know how long he sat there. And people are gravitating in. And he's just watching the crowds gather, and they're coming, and they're coming, and they're coming, and people are waiting, anticipating, when's he going to start? What's he going to say? And then he starts. And when we think about these words, I want you to think about how he starts this sermon. There's no introduction. There's no, I'm glad you're here. What a beautiful day to come and hear, blah, blah, blah. No. He just starts in, and he just starts dropping these thunderbolts. Just bam, bam. Just let that wash over for you a minute and imagine that's what has happened tonight, that we've all, Jesus is in his room and we've all gathered and we're, what's he going to say? What's he going to say? And this is how he starts. So let's read through these Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, they shall be comforted. Blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Pause. Next. Y'all are amazing. And this will just stay up, and I just hit next. Okay. So we're going to see this on the screen. Jonathan told me when I left, he said, well, I've got 5 minutes. I can figure this out. And he did.
There may be a bit of a delay.
Okay. Thank you. Those people are amazing. Those people. Jonathan and Kendricks, and just amazing. Okay, so you can look at the screen now. And let's continue in verse 6. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Okay, we've heard those 100 times. I'm hoping we listen to them with fresh ears. We let them wash over us personally. And, you know, we talked about these a few weeks back, but tonight we want to go through them quickly but individually and see that they are all speaking to us, challenging us, motivating, convicting. So how do these wash over you? As the first things he chooses to say, and let's not contemplate again what he said to them, but let's think about what he is saying to us, what he says to me. Are these thunderbolts to me? Why not? Is there too much familiarity? Do I have contempt with him? So I'm interested in your thoughts about the first words he chooses. You can see on the screen. Is that odd? Is it, what are your reactions? Got a seat right there in the middle. And I'm going to advance to that slide. It's got a little bit of the different language from the versions on it, but you know, there's the blessed are those who statements, and then for theirs is, for they shall. But that's our content. What do you think? Is it odd? An odd way to start? Not really. Yeah, okay.
It's not easy to do.
Okay.
I think it's encouraging.
What if you feel like, am I poor in spirit?
You wouldn't know that.
Right.
But it's a positive on the back end.
Yeah.
Morning, it's a positive on the back end.
Yeah. Yeah. I see what you're saying. If you're poor in spirit, the kingdom of heaven, all right.
Yeah.
Well, and it is, I mean, I have, just the fact that he starts it with blessed, or, I mean, it's not automatically viewed as a negative. He's not chastising with the way he's starting. But if you understand what he's saying, it's certainly chastising some of them.
Yeah, okay.
But it's not presented in a negative light.
Right. These are just the facts, people.
Right.
Yeah. Rick? Yeah, I like that thought. These are not, we see this language littered throughout the prophets, right? I mean, this is not unfamiliar territory to a practicing Jew or a scribe or a Pharisee or some of those audience members. Is it unfamiliar to us? You know, are these things that are just embedded on our heart? Or do we get distracted from this content by other things? You know, how does it hit us? Are those things that I focus on, sorry, I was taking notes on my hand this morning, are those things that I focus on daily, that I think about, am I being a peacemaker? Am I poor in spirit? Am I meek and gentle in this situation? That's where it's starting to hit me. And they drop like pretty big bombs when I think about them in the context of my everyday life.
Well, I guess, I don't know where I struggle. Well, I probably struggle with all of these, but there are certain ones that I feel like I'm better at than others. And yet, I also sit there and go, but are they supposed to build on one another? So in other words, can I not really be a peacemaker if I don't hunger and thirst after righteousness, or if I'm not poor in spirit? I mean, because some of those I feel more comfortable with and are more who I am.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I'm all of those things. And do I need to go in that order? Obviously, I need to work on all of them. But is it easier if I'm poor in spirit and all the rest easily flow?
Yeah.
Or if I hunger and thirst after righteousness, I will become poor in spirit.
Yeah.
That's where I struggle with this list. And trying to truly make it a heart thing for me.
I love that thought, because I've had the same struggle in my mind, and I wrote this statement down and scratched through it because I was like, oh, I can't reconcile it in my head. But to have one, this is what I wrote down that I marked out, so don't take me to task on this one. To have one is to have all. To lack one is to lack all. And what I meant by that is, you know, we talked about this being a garment. It's like Jesus describing a coat that you wear. I'm describing individual nuances of the lapel, of the buttons, of the pockets. They all go together. I can't just rip this pocket out and say, well, I don't have that, and it still be a jacket. It just, you got a big hole in your jacket. And so to me, these connect to each other so integrally that, how would I hunger and thirst for righteousness if I wasn't poor in spirit? How can I be pure in heart and not be gentle? You know, just any one of them that I pick and work back and forth, maybe with the exception of verse 10, I struggle to reconcile lacking in one area but being strong in another. You know, they're just so tied together. But I don't think about them that way when I read this.
There's a part of me that says that's absolutely true, but on the other hand, for example, mourning. Well, I don't think it's, I don't know. To the extent that's mourning for sin, obviously in my initial relationship with God, I may have more sin to mourn over.
Yes.
As I've become more and more like Him and less prone to sin, am I mourning as much?
Yeah.
Or am I mourning over other sins now instead of my own sins.
Yeah.
Or, I mean,
yeah.
So I don't know. That's where I go back and forth of how much is it a progression of thoughts, and you have to have all of them, or you're not blessed in any way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. Or do some of those play a bigger role at different times in my life?
Yeah. And that those are the thoughts we got to wrestle. We got to just wrestle them down and work them. And, you know, I think we're gonna try to rip through these individually without spending too much time and not getting to salt and light. But, you know, when we think about mourning, I mean, there's so many layers to that. You know, I can be forgiven and I can still mourn the fact that I had to be, that Jesus had to die, and on and on and on, just so many layers. But as a whole person, as a kingdom citizen, these things describe me. So really, really good thoughts. Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Your dad had me.
It's not a math problem.
Yeah.
Right, like you don't have to, it doesn't have to be this plus this equals this, right? It's, I mean, if you're poor in spirit and if you've been persecuted, the kingdom of heaven is yours.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think some things go together more, but I don't think it's that. It doesn't have to be everything 100%. Like, you have to be mourning all the time and gentle all the time, and like, because there might not be that opportunity. It's not I don't think it's a math problem.
So I like where you're going, and we have to be working toward all of this. But Mark Thomas, when I'm preparing for a class, I hear the material everywhere, right? In Hunter's talk this morning, you know, who then is this? I was like, that's the Sermon on the Mount. And in Mark's prayer this morning, you know, Mark talked about not about perfection, it's about persistence, right? What a powerful thought. The content here is not about perfection, it's about persistence. It's about how we approach these things and how we work on them and just persist. Very powerful thought, very challenging thought. You know, kingdom citizen qualities, how we weigh our efforts, our intentions, our actions against these things. Yes. What is it I have to work on to see God? Yeah. Yeah. Which is back to the positive of, whoa, look at the things I can have. And, you know, I think about how this kingdom address begins, you know, who is in, who necessarily is out, this radical, total absoluteness of it all. And if you want to be in this kingdom, you're going to have to be something different than what you see around you. And, you know, we have to change completely to give ourselves totally to Him. And Jesus doesn't want us naive about what that means. But I think about an earthly king or a ruler or an elected official in our country. When they're giving an address about this is what this kingdom is about, what are the things that they highlight? Is this how somebody would start that's on the campaign trail, or the new king of a country that says, hey, let me tell you how it's going to be? Is this how they would start? What is different about this as Jesus ushers in his kingdom?
He's putting a responsibility on you, not on him as the ruler.
Okay, I like that. In this kingdom, these are all the things you can have if. Any other thoughts? So one of the things I was thinking about is, you know, most kingdom speeches, a leader is establishing their authority to some degree, right? They're saying, let me tell you how good it's going to be. Let me tell you what I'm fixing to do. Let me tell you how great, blah, 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 blah. And Jesus does that on the right side, but these conditions are, we got to do this together. You don't get to participate in this from the sidelines. This isn't me doing or demanding, or I'm just telling you the way it is. I don't even have to make the demand. If you want this, you'll be this. That's pretty powerful. And again, the challenge for me is it puts it right back in my lap. So I want to go kind of, yes.
The Old Testament was a lot about like what you needed to do.
Yeah.
And what he's saying here is this is who you need to be.
I love it. Yeah.
And that was the problem with the Pharisees, right? Like every
real good at what we do.
This, and this, and this is, you know.
Yeah.
They were good. And then he's like, no, you just need to be this.
Can't you just tell me what to do?
No.
Yeah, yeah, I like that. Who we need to be, not what we have to do. Okay, so let's dive off into each of these, and we'll try to go through quickly and get to the salt and light. But when we think about, I'm just going to go in order here, but when we think about poor in spirit, what is poor in spirit? What does that mean? You can have the kingdom of heaven if you're poor in spirit. Blessed are those who are poor in spirit. And again, let's reconnect to blessed. Another thing that stood out to me in Mark's prayer this morning, Mark said, we're so blessed to live in this country, to live in this state, to be a part of this church. Absolutely true. Not the same kind of blessed that is talking about here. This is favor with God that we have garnered because we're this. So when we think about poor in spirit, what does that mean? Devoid of spiritual arrogance. What would spiritual arrogance look like?
Thinking you're better.
Yeah.
Thinking that you have it down. Thinking that you're more significant.
Yeah.
That you're better at all this than everybody else.
In some way, I deserve. I'm owed. I've done enough to. Yeah, I like that. Other thoughts? At its core, this is about our attitude about ourselves before God, right? How we see ourselves standing before Him. It's not economic poverty. These poor here are those who, whether they possess little or much, we have this sense of our own spiritual destitution. And so the Greek word here, and I'm not going off into Greek because I can't, but the Greek word here, it relates to cringe or to crouch. And so in my notes, I threw Lazarus out to the side. You know, you think about Luke 16, this abject begging because we have absolutely nothing else. I got nothing else. I gotta beg. That level of destitution. And what I would say about that for us, Americans, 21st century, begging comes hard to us. And we're proud, we're self-reliant, we're self-confident, we're self lots of other words. And but that is exactly where our sin, our sinful ways have put us. They put us in a position of crouching, cringing, begging. And what this verse tells us is we will not see the kingdom until we face up to that humble simplicity. Rick?
So if I translate that personally, it would be crying, God, you have all the answers. Help me, show me, help me see your ways.
Yeah.
Because I don't have the answers.
I got nothing. Yeah.
You got it. I want it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the begging part, please.
Yeah.
Impart.
I like that. That's good. Okay, let's go to mourn. We talked a little bit about mourn here in a second. And when we think about what it is, sometimes it's helpful to think about what it's not. And so this morning, you know, the writer of Ecclesiastes, in Ecclesiastes 7, talks about mourning. I'm not going to go there and read that. Again, in Psalm 119, it's good for me, Psalm 119, it's good for me that I have been afflicted, that I may learn your statutes. There's this link between pain and understanding. Before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I keep your word. This mourning is not that. It's not necessarily what happens to me. There's something more to this type of mourning than just tears that we can't escape, that sorrow that comes whether we're looking for it or not. This is a type of grief that comes to us by choice. In Isaiah 61, I think Rick was talking from 66 earlier, but in Isaiah 61, heal the brokenhearted. Listen to this, Isaiah 61, comfort all who mourn. The prophets talked about that. God is going to send the Messiah who will comfort all who mourn. And so this is, the prophets would have understood this mourning as the grief that they experienced in their reverence for God, horrified at their own sins, at those of their fellows, moved to tears of shame and grief, the godly sorrow Paul writes about that goes to repentance. And so these are tears that we choose to shed, not that happen to us. They're tears that I choose to shed because of my poor in spirit, my nature before God, etc. Thoughts, comments, disagreements? We're going to keep moving. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. This is a tough one for me. The meek inherit the earth. What does inherit the earth mean? How does that go? Meekness here, how do some other versions translate that? What are some other words? Humble? Self-control. I read from the American Standard, and it's gentle. Blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth. I love some of the words Paul Earnhardt uses, but this is how he introduces this. In a world of harshness and cruelty, meekness would appear to be a quick way to commit suicide. The meek are summarily run over. People that are drawn to the kingdom of God must face that. The gentleness of Jesus did not save him. Wow. That's a ton of bricks for me, because I think about harm that might come to my family, the way one of my children might be treated unjustly, and I'm ready to stand up and defend. And meekness is not weakness. It is not an indifference to evil. It's not flabby at all. Jesus was gentle and lowly in heart, but he could have dropped bombs. And this is an attitude toward God and towards others that's a product of choice. And specifically, it's more derived about our view of ourselves in relation to others than it is of ourselves in relation to God. Both are a component, but how do we view ourselves around other people, in the context of other people? And so, we've got this example of Jesus in Philippians 2, the humble servant who emptied himself. And that the word, you've heard this described before about how it's used as a bridle for an animal. We take on the yoke of Christ. This is a person that no longer seeks to take by force even that which is rightfully his or hers. We've submitted our cause to a higher court. And I'm going to read another Earnhardt quote from you because it's just so good. The meek man has had enough of himself. He has felt his own ultimate spiritual emptiness, yearned for a right relationship with God. Self-righteousness, self-will, self-confidence, self-assertiveness are a stench in his nostrils. He's emptied his heart of self, filled it with God and others, and like his master, become the ultimate servant. And for this very reason, the future belongs to him. Man, there's about 3 years of work for me in that short little verse. Just a lot for us to contemplate and chew on. Thoughts about that? I don't want this to be heavy, because the right-hand side is amazing. Look at the opportunities that we have, but we do need to understand it's a lot of work. It's an investment that we're all in on. Okay, so hunger and thirst. Somebody describe hunger and thirst for me. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be satisfied. They will be filled. What does it mean to hunger and thirst? Is that something we identify with well in this country? No. Hunger and thirst.
It has to be a desire, right? Mm. At that level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The same word here is the word used when Jesus fasted for 40 days in the wilderness and was hungry. 40 days without food. I just read this book where this Antarctic expedition and the last 3 weeks of this guy trying to get back to camp, he was eating 4 ounces of food a day, rationing his meals, just wasting away. A man like that knows hunger, knows what hunger is. And when we recognize what hunger is, we'll do anything to satiate that appetite. And that's what we're talking about here. It's a hunger for righteousness. This right relationship with God is part of it, but the righteousness of a transformed life is the other. Yes. Yeah. That was a great quote this morning. Yeah. Jeff said, nature abhors a vacuum. If you don't desire God, then you're going to desire the world, right? It's one or the other. Yeah, we have this God-shaped emptiness, and there's nothing we can do here to fill it. We can't have enough, do enough, experience enough to fill that hole aside from the righteousness that's described here. Yeah.
I guess the one thing I would say that I worry about us is when we talk about hunger and thirsting for righteousness, we're looking externally. We want the world to be right.
Yeah.
We look at what's wrong in the world. We complain about what's wrong in the world. And I'm not sure that's what this is referencing. I think it's a hunger and thirsting that righteousness will be a part of us.
Yes.
Because if we do hunger and thirst for that, then we will be filled up with God's righteousness. And then we may make a difference in the world by how we are righteous, because it's not our righteousness. God's righteousness, but I think way too much we're looking externally and wanting the world to be made right, as opposed to wanting ourselves to be made right.
I wholeheartedly agree. That is just a fantastic segue into verses 13 to 16. You know, we're to be light and salt, and if we get this right about us, it preserves and illuminates others. And some of you may listen to the Excel Still More podcast that Chris Emerson does, probably about 6 weeks back, the week after the Uvalde shootings. He talked about this as we pray we need God back in our schools, right? We need God to be predominant in our families and to help our families be whole. And he said, yeah, God's saying, what are you doing about it? Where are you? What if God needs to be back in the schools, get back in the schools. And I think we do that. It's neat for us when we don't know what starving feels like. It's neat for us to say that needs to be different over there and not recognize I'm an instrument to make the difference. I think those are really powerful thoughts. I would recommend that podcast. Okay, let's go to the merciful. What does that mean? That's an easy one, right? Is it showing compassion to the helpless? Yeah. Yeah. Does it go deeper? This idea that we can't merit the grace of God, and a recognition, our own sense of gratitude for the mercy that he's shown us. I can see that really easy in other people, in my kids, in, you know, we just told you you could do this and you're going to tell her that she can't. I can see it so clearly. I got work in that area, but back to poor in spirit, those that mourn, this idea of mercy, when I contemplate the mercy that's shown to me for my sin, the relationship that has been, the gap that has been filled for me, boy, that extends to everybody else that I run into. It's a different kind of relationship to the world. We're clipping along because we're running out of time. The pure in heart. What is pure in heart?
All of these things seem to require vulnerability on your part.
Say more. I love that. So, everything requires vulnerability. So, how does being pure in heart make me vulnerable?
Because like you say, we live in a tricky world, so you're just going to walk around telling the truth, what's going to happen to you.
Yeah. Boy, that's pretty plain right there. We live in a tricky world, don't we? And when we're honest with ourselves, we're constantly trying to navigate that trickiness. And how do I navigate that and stay completely lined up with myself, with this hunger that I have for righteousness, to be poor in spirit, to be gentle, merciful. And I'm trying to stay lined up with that in this tricky world. How in the world do I do that? That's what pure in heart is all about. You know, Jesus talked about Nathanael, a man in whom was no guile. You know, Jeff introduced Caleb Churchill when he was here with that same phrase. Caleb's just a person that what you see is what you get. There's no agenda. There's no ulterior motive. This is utter sincerity, just complete sincerity. It does not refer to a perfect righteous life. That's not what it is. It's just completely sincere purity of a single-minded devotion. It's not, I've got one foot in one camp and one foot in the other, and I'm trying to have them both over here, but this toe kind of gives me some advantages that I can leverage, and I can use that toe for God. And no, it's not in the right. No, it's just, I'm going to let the rest of it be worked out, but I'm right here. I'm just solely focused. You know, James 4:8, draw near to God, he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. This isn't calculating and playing dishonest games. Just absolute single-heartedness. And those that are single-hearted, they will see God. David said in Psalm 24, may ascend into the hill. Who may ascend into the hill of the Lord or stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart. The pure in heart will see God. Tough one. Okay, let's go to peacemakers. What's a peacemaker? You got a gift for smoothing things out, right? That's what it is? Okay. I'm pulling an audible here. We've got 7 minutes, and I've got to get to salt and light. So, peacemakers, persecuted for righteousness, work on them. Okay, so we're going to verse 13. And these are described as the, we had the Beatitudes, These are what? What's the other word that we call these? Anybody know? The similitudes. Have you ever heard that? Nobody's ever heard that? So these are referred to as the similitudes. And similes?
Yes.
So it's the idea that we are similar in appearance or character or nature to the one who has called us. This is, if this is the gospel of the kingdom and these are who is in the kingdom, these verses represent our calling. The one who has called us, what he is engaged in, and what he's asked us to be engaged in. So we've heard this 100 times, but we are in the world, but not of the world. And we recognize that we have to be separated to this new life. And that separation will certainly seal a bitter reaction to our lives. We'll be slandered, assaulted, rejected. We live in a tricky world, and if I'm going to be pure in heart, those things are going to happen. Our gentle and humble ways will not suffice to relieve us of embarrassment or intimidation or fear. Those things are destined to come to us. That's what this is about. And yet, ironically, we've been called to help the very people who inflict us with those things. So it's ironic that Jesus, when we look at this text, he's talking to, think about the crowd that he's talking to. You are the salt of the earth. John brought this out a couple of times in previous weeks. He's saying, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. And think about this ragtag bunch of people. I mean, poor, and he's saying, you're going to be the light of the world. And they got to be looking around going, what are you talking about? That hunger and thirst, I understand. I'm starving right now. You got anything to eat? This is what survives when everything else, the Roman Empire was everything then. The Roman Empire is gone. It fell. Plato's Academy closed. The great library at Alexandria burned. Christianity remained. This is what's left. So it shouldn't be a surprise to us that Jesus, as he came and sought to save the lost, this lost humanity, he would draw people to him that he sought to teach to do the same thing. And so when we read these verses, you're the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, oh, I got to go past. Sorry, I got slides and They're in there going, why did we go to work for him? He's not even using those things. You're the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It is good for nothing anymore except to be thrown out, trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do men light a lamp and put it under the peck measure, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. How do you react to those verses? What do they make you think?
Responsibility.
I'm a kingdom citizen. I got responsibilities. It's not all just fun and games. What else?
It's the people who are being the light and who are being the salt, and as a result, more people are coming to him and becoming, glorifying God and becoming another part of the light and another part of the salt.
this world around us is in decay and darkness, and we've been charged to preserve and illuminate it, you know, to embed ourselves in a way that people see in us how to stem the rot and to enlighten the darkness. It's a powerful responsibility.
He also doesn't say to go tell people about your good works.
Yeah.
He says he wants people to see your good works. And yeah. That's a big difference. It's not, you don't go around beating people over the head.
Yeah.
With what you've done or who you are, but they see who you are.
Which is right back to poor in spirit, right. Humble, you know, all of those things, that connection. I like that thought. I just read a book Rebecca gave to me about an Auschwitz survivor and just the terrible things that he endured, and his struggle throughout the book was, I can't lose my compassion. I want to really bad. I hate what is being done to me and what I see done to others, but I can't lose my compassion. They can't take that from me. I've got the ability to continue to be compassionate, and I don't want to lose that. And that was his struggle throughout the book. You know, we may be persecuted as he was, but we can't allow our pain to dry up our compassion. I want to read one thing to you, and I'll leave the class with you. One final thought. As important as it is for Christians to worship God according to his will, we must remember that most lost men will not be made to glorify God because we eat the Lord's Supper every Sunday. They may indeed be moved to exalt God by the quiet love with which we bear one another, by our self-control in the face of great provocation, by our calm assurance in the presence of tragedy, and our firm refusal to be drawn into a world of mindless lust. If we have gained the victory over a worldly system of pride and carnality, it will surely show, and God, not ourselves, will be glorified. Thank you.